Chapter 4. A Brief Review. The single biggest problem in communication is the illusion that it has taken place. George Bernard Shaw. You can skip this chapter, but if you get confused later about the terms and concepts we're using and the relationships between them, come back here to find it all explained. If you didn't read Damnedest and Incorrect, you should definitely spend a few minutes here. The dream state paradigm. Reality is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. Albert Einstein. The reality we seem to be experiencing and sharing is consensual reality. In no respect can it be distinguished from a dream. Spiritual enlightenment. If you have the choice between enlightenment and $1 million, take the $1 million. Because if you get the $1 million, there will be somebody there to enjoy the $1 million. But if you get enlightenment, there's no one there to enjoy the enlightenment. Ramesh Balsekar. The first thing to understand about the term spiritual enlightenment is that it's a clunker. The term, not the state, though the state has nothing to recommend it either. No one actually in this state would ever have decided to call it spiritual enlightenment, yet no other state merits such a title. Some would argue that certain non-ordinary states, such as cosmic consciousness and God consciousness, are worthy of so illustrious a designation, and if they were any more abiding than guffaw consciousness, I might agree. As it is, my former bond broker had more than 30 experiences of direct, timeless union with the God mind. And now, he's just another John Q. Schlub pushing product and riding the train. So the way I see it, if it ain't abiding, it ain't shit. Just another ride in the park. Spiritual enlightenment is the state in which the self is free of all delusion, including self itself. Truth realization is another useful term to describe this state. Untruth, unrealization, is more accurate, but less wieldy. Abiding non-dual awareness has its good points, too. The process of becoming enlightened is a deliberate act of self-annihilation. It is the false self that does the killing, and the false self that dies. A suicide in all but the physical sense. Because there is no true self to fill the vacancy created by the passing of the false self, no self remains. Hence, it is rightly said that no self is true self. It is not possible to knowledgeably choose or want spiritual enlightenment. To desire it is to misunderstand it. Ego cannot desire egolessness. One does not undergo the process of awakening out of love for the truth, but out of hatred for the false. A hatred so intense that it burns everything and spares nothing. Maya, architect of delusion. As soon as man awakens for a moment and opens his eyes, all the forces that caused him to fall asleep begin to act upon him with tenfold energy, and he immediately falls asleep again, very often dreaming that he is awake or is awakening. Gurdjieff. Maya might best be understood as the intelligence of fear. She is the keeper of the kept, the warden of the dream state. It is Maya who bestows upon us the miraculous and life-giving power to see what's not and to not see what is. It is Maya who makes the dream state possible and escape from it nearly impossible. She enables the dream state to exist, and if you wish to awaken from it, then it's her you must destroy, layer by layer. But don't live in metaphors. She's not a she, and she's not external to you. She's inside you, and those layers are the stuff of which your ego is made. Maya is the structural integrity of ego. Observe ego at work. Make a study of it. Dissect it. Reverse engineer it. Maya is not a person or a concept or a goddess. There is no way to understand what Maya is except to grapple with her. There is no way to know how deep she goes until you have gone that deep. In this war, Maya has every advantage but one. Truth. Maya doesn't exist. Truth does. Human adulthood and human childhood, integrated state and segregated state. There is nothing in a caterpillar that tells you it's going to be a butterfly. R. Buckminster Fuller. There came a time when the risk to remain tight in the bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom. Aeneas Nin. Human childhood is the ego-bound state. It is, in human children, a healthy and natural state. In human adults, however, it's a hideous affliction. The only way such an affliction could go undetected and unremedied is if everyone were equally afflicted, which is exactly the case. No problem is recognized, and no alternative is known, so no solution is sought, and no hope for change exists. We live our entire lives under false pretenses, in a case of mistaken identity. We subscribe fully and without reservation to our false selfhood, mistaking these two-dimensional roles we play for who and what we really are. In fact, we should be discarding these juvenile disguises in our early teens and embarking on life journeys of such superiority that, by contrast, the ego-bound life is not life at all. Think of a grasshopper caught in a spider's web, injected with a non-lethal poison, and then cocooned in layer upon layer of silk thread. Kept alive for freshness, but tightly bound to prevent thrashing or escape. It is still alive, but bears no resemblance to its authentic grasshopper self. That state of immobilized, narcotized stupor fairly represents the state of the chronic human child, misapprehended worldwide as a normally developed adult. And the spider fairly represents Maya. Most human beings cease to develop at around the age of 10 or 12. The average 70-year-old is often a 10-year-old with 60 years time in grade. Our societies are of, by, and for human children, which explains the self-perpetuating nature of this ghoulish malady, as well as most of the silliness we see in the world. The human child who has spent years at the same developmental stage understands growth as a process of solidification, of slow hardening into a rigid mass. In our world of human children, this mortification of the spirit is considered normal, healthy, and respectable. If we gauge societies in light of the developmental maturity of their citizens, we see very little difference, even between extremes. One society may be, on average, slightly further along than another, but the reality is that no society has advanced beyond the stage where girls play dress-up and boys torture frogs. If we lived in a society conducive to healthy, normal development, everyone would outgrow childhood in the personality structure at the same time we outgrow it in the physical structure. But there is no such society, and no reason to think that there ever will be. We are trapped in a state of self-aware simian consciousness. That is the human condition. Any of the negative things we might say about people in general, that we're greedy, corrupt, apathetic, stupid, hateful, violent, etc., are not symptoms of the human animal or the self-aware being, but of human childhood. Human childhood, though, is itself just a symptom of the one core disease from which all others radiate. Fear. Fear is the natural and certain state of one who lives with eyes closed. Ignorance is the condition of thinking one's closed eyes are open and that the world of one's imagining is the world as it exists. For a person to transition into human adulthood at an appropriate developmental age would require an actual rite of passage, rather than a merely symbolic ceremony, as it is sometimes observed. But it would take much more than that. It would require a society of human adults in which to occur, so it won't. That's the bad news. For a person to transition into human adulthood at an inappropriate developmental age, however, can and does occur. That's the good news. The individual who wants to achieve change and growth in his own life, who wants to move beyond the state of developmental retardation imposed by a developmentally retarded society, can probably do so. There's no saying what's possible for whom, but I feel pretty confident in saying that anyone who can understand their captivity and desire their freedom would find it possible to bring about a dramatic change in their condition. This is where the sincere seeker must make the most rigorous and concentrated effort. If we don't get this, we don't get anything. It's not enough to kind of get it. We have to grok it, live it, and breathe it. Make it our own personal religion and become fanatic about it. We must learn to see the difference between a human adult and a human child as easily and unmistakably as we see the difference between a 60-year-old and a 6-year-old. This may sound a little weird, but your ego is smarter than you, way smarter. And if you don't recognize that and respect it, you stand very little chance against it. I've seen many very insightful books by very brainy men and women who are experts on the subject of ego transcendence, but who, I could easily tell, had not transcended their own egos. The spiritual religious marketplace, which should be dedicated entirely to ministering to this all-important developmental advent, is, in fact, arrayed almost entirely against it. Ego doesn't need to be killed because it was never really alive. You don't have to destroy your false self because it's not real, which is really the whole point. It's just a character we play, and what needs to be killed is that part of us that identifies with the character. Once that's done, really done, and it can take years. Then you can wear the costume and play the character as it suits you to do so. Now in the character, but not of the character. Human adulthood versus spiritual enlightenment. What is the greatest thing ye can experience? It is the hour of great contempt, the hour in which even your happiness becometh loathsome unto you, and so also your reason and virtue. Friedrich Nietzsche. The difference between adulthood and enlightenment is that the former is awakening within the dream state, and the latter is awakening from it. Shallow, early stage adulthood is often mistaken for and sold as spiritual enlightenment, but it's not. It's just the first real glimpse of life, the death-rebirth transition from womb to world. The most important distinction to be made between these two states is that human adulthood makes sense and enlightenment doesn't. The main benefit most spiritually inclined people can derive from having a clear understanding of what it really means to be truth realized is not so they can achieve it, but so they can dispense with it and reset their spiritual sights on something worthier than enlightenment, which is literally the biggest nothing of all time. Human adulthood is what everyone really wants, not truth or enlightenment. This is where you find all the good stuff and a lot less of the bad. You have to grow into it, of course, continue to develop and mature, learn and expand, but that's where all the perks are. Profound and abiding contentment, the ability to manifest desires and shape events, the ability to do less and accomplish more, find your true calling, connect with your higher self, never stub another toe, and so on. And human adulthood is what everyone, spiritual or not, religious or not, atheist or not, should be setting their sights on. This is what I've come to understand in my years of teaching and writing. If I were to give advice, I would recommend adulthood to everyone and enlightenment to no one. Human adulthood is life positive. Enlightenment is life negative. Human adulthood is the real prize. Spiritual enlightenment is pointless and meaningless and should only be sought by those who have absolutely no choice in the matter. Simplicity. Veritatis simplex oratio est. The language of truth is simple. Seneca. The journey of awakening is, despite our endless desire to complicate it, perfectly simple. Anytime we get muddled, disoriented, feel weak in heart, or clouded in mind, get our heads turned around by some spiritual sales pitch or philosophical argument or guru du jour, we need only return to simplicity. There is nothing to learn, nothing to know, nothing to practice, nothing to become. Focus and intent. It is impossible to imagine Goethe or Beethoven being good at billiards or golf. H.L. Mencken. The vast majority of spiritual seekers are motivated by desire, so the failure of their search is a foregone conclusion, as is amply evidenced by mankind's history of near total inability to find the one thing that can never be lost. How is it possible that something as simple as seeing what is manages to elude even our most devout seekers and our greatest minds? because no one really wants what awakening really is. We may express a vague sort of desire to awaken, but we want a very specific kind of awakening, the kind that doesn't require us to leave our cozy dream state, or, better yet, makes it even cozier. We don't want to awaken from the dream. We want to dream that we are awake. The true desire that drives the process of awakening is more akin to a psychotic madness. It is a wickedly profound and protracted crisis, not the dreary little dark night of the soul the hucksters pawn off on the tourists. Many people hear the ringing alarm in life, the call to awaken, but what we really want, more than sex, power, fame, love, immortality, or money, is to hit the snooze button and go back to sleep. When life calls, all we want to do is pull the covers over our head and roll over, and, above all, keep our eyes closed. The last thing anyone really wants, whatever they might say, is to have their slumber disturbed. Surrender. One thing only I know, and that is that I know nothing. Socrates. To surrender is to relinquish the illusion of control, which initiates the death part of the death-rebirth process, which is the transition from the bondage of the womb-like, segregated state to the freedom of the ever-expanding, integrated state. No faith or belief is required to accomplish this act of surrender, only clear seeing. When one begins to understand ego and fear for what they really are, then this process becomes as easy and natural as dropping a heavy weight. Sadly, owing to the faux surrender popularized by pop Christianity, jailhouse conversions, and 12-step programs, this vital and necessary growth stage has fallen into disrepute and is widely scorned as the desperate act of the stupid, the frightened, and the weak. This is a clear example of how Maya operates in the world. The price of truth. A taste for truth at any cost is a passion which spares nothing. Albert Camus. The price of truth is everything. The price of truth is nothing. This is another way of stating the gateless gate paradox. From the unawakened side, the gate blocking one from enlightenment is enormous and impassable. Delusion fills one's entire field of view because it resides prior to perception. Once delusion has been destroyed, we can see that it never really existed. Ignorance. The greatest obstacle to discovery is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge. Danielle Boorstin. There are two kinds of ignorance. One is the relatively benign kind, where we don't know or understand something. This kind is not usually a big troublemaker. If you don't know how to change the oil in your car, you hire someone to do it. If you don't know how to make lasagna, you buy a cookbook. If you don't know how to skydive, you don't jump out of airplanes. The other kind of ignorance is the perniciously debilitating kind. It's the kind where we think we know something we don't know, or that we understand something we don't understand. The former type of ignorance is what most spiritual aspirants waste their lives trying to address, never realizing that it's the latter that enslaves them. Spiritual autolysis. Thought must be divided against itself before it can come to any knowledge of itself. Aldous Huxley. To hold a pen is to be at war. Voltaire. Spiritual autolysis is a writing process that allows us to utilize the fullest potential of our intelligence by bringing the mind into the sharpest possible focus. Autolysis means self-digestion, and that's the purpose of this technique. Unlike journaling or keeping a spiritual diary, it's all about finding and illuminating the next obstacle to our progress. It is not concerned with finding answers, but questions. There are no answers to be found, only the questions that define our limitations. Understand the question, and you destroy the limitation. It is through courageous thought and clear seeing that delusion is destroyed. Everyone thinks they think, but when someone begins to truly think, surgically, unemotionally, destructively, they quickly see that it's not something they've ever really done before. It is by writing, by externalizing the thought process, by depersonalizing it, by standing back from it, and representing all sides in an organized and objective manner, that we are able to unleash an intellectual ferocity of which we are normally incapable and unaware. A good way to start is to write down a statement you're sure is true, and then try to figure out exactly why the statement is false, which, unless you have stated a negative, no belief is true, made a subjective observation, my foot hurts, or wrote the only true thing you know, I am, it is. Fear. Taking a new step, uttering a new word, is what people fear most. Fyodor Dostoevsky. Fear is the prime emotion of the eyes closed state. All emotions are attachments, and the energy source of all attachments is fear. Fear of what? Fear of no self. The nameless, faceless dread of non-being. Not just fear of death, which anyone can deny or explain away, but fear of nothingness, which no fairy tale can fix. Gratitude. If the only prayer you say in your whole life is thank you, that will suffice. Meister Eckhart. Gratitude of a non-specific, all-encompassing quality and tinged with a not unpleasant sadness might be said to be the primary emotion of the truth-realized person and the mature human adult. It is this gratitude that comes in as fear goes out. Further, when you reach the top, keep climbing. Zen proverb. The word further is like a talisman, a power object. We must pull it out and gaze upon it after every battle. Every time we think we must be done, that we must, at last, have arrived. As much as it may seem otherwise, there's always further. Get up, dust off, and gird thy loins for the next fray. Carl Jung said he had to descend 1,000 ladders to arrive at the little clod of earth he really was. At each landing, he must have thought himself done, until his eyes adjusted and he saw that there was yet another ladder to descend. If Dr. Jung had command of the word further, he would have known that there were more ladders still, and that a little clod of earth was infinitely more than he actually was. Whenever you're sure you've arrived, there's always further. The day may come when there is no more further, and you will recognize that fact, not with fanfare and ticker tape, not with radiant backlighting and choirs of angels, but with the bemused and unenthusiastic observation that you are done. Done means done. Chapter 5. A Brief Preview. 'Tis the good reader that makes the good book. In every book he finds passages which seem confidences or asides, hidden from all else, and unmistakably meant for his ear. The profit of books is according to the sensibility of the reader. The profoundest thought or passion sleeps as in a mine, until it is discovered by an equal mind and heart. Ralph Waldo Emerson. You can skip this chapter, but if you get confused later about the three houses, or the two women, or the two men, or the girl, or the dog, or the locales, come back here to find it explained. If you're still confused, it's my fault. I overwrote the book by a few hundred pages, and in cutting it down, we lost some of the narrative detail and a lot of local color, but saved most of the substance. This chapter replaces four chapters of exposition that provided some clarifying backstory that Lisa, my editorial assistant, has urged me to boil down to one short chapter. So here it is. Lisa didn't start out as my editorial assistant. I met her through her father, Frank, who told me a little about the crisis she was undergoing and suggested that it might have something to do with my books. Intrigued by her walking, wounded demeanor, her thousand-mile gaze, and her tightly clutched day planner, I invited her and her daughter, Maggie, to come live in the guest house on the estate I'm renting. After some discussion, she gratefully accepted. It was only later that she started helping with the book. Lisa is the grown daughter of Frank. She's also an attorney, the wife of a dentist, the mother of two kids, Maggie and DJ, and a reluctant spiritual journeyer. She's in the final stages of a very hairy existential meltdown that has been slowly consuming her for 3 years. Frank, her dad, is a retired university professor who invited me down to visit him at his retirement home in the Mexican state of Jalisco. He lives in a community called Lakeside, which is actually made up of several towns along the north shore of Lake Chapala. Frank's wife, Isabel, died the previous year, leaving Frank at somewhat loose ends. I decided to accept Frank's oft-repeated invitation to visit him in Mexico for two reasons. One was the content of the 31 emails he wrote to me and the free access he offered to his uniquely stocked private library. The other was my grandfather. My grandfather, actually my grandfather's brother, now long dead, had a 20-acre ranchito a few miles outside the Mexican town of San Miguel de Allende. That's where he retired after a long and successful career in law. He wasn't Mexican and didn't speak Spanish. He just wanted to fully retire and have some horses and live out his life quietly. I spent a few summers at his hacienda as a kid, and it had impressed itself upon me as the ideal home. He was a cantankerous old bastard who didn't like anybody, his more direct relations least of all. But he liked me well enough, possibly because I enjoyed fishing with him, could memorize long passages of Byron, his beloved poet, and because I was mostly quiet. "What happens when two snakes start eating each other's tails and keep eating?" he he asked me when I was formally introduced to him at the age of 8. I thought about it for a moment before answering. "I don't know, sir," I said.
"Goddamn right you don't," he said.
And that was that. We met once a year after that.
"Figure it out yet?" he'd asked.
"No, sir," I'd answer.
"Still working on it?" he'd ask.
"Yes, sir," I'd answer.
"Good man," he'd reply.
And that was the full extent of our relationship until, at 12, I was invited to spend a month with him in Mexico over the summer break. I accepted and went that year and for the next few until other interests and commitments forced me to decline his invitation. Despite the fact that there was never anything like a conversation between us, or because of it, we got on very well. I've lived in a bunch of places in the last 2 decades, some for a few years, many for only a few months, but none where I felt like I'd want to settle in for good. It was when I asked myself where I did want to live that my grandfather's hacienda came clearly to mind. I never thought of actually buying it, but it was the overall feeling I remembered from his place that I was always trying to rediscover in others. That was what I thought a home should be. So, while wintering in the off-season New England resort community, wondering where I'd like to go next, and with it starting to look like I'd be writing a third book, I came across a folder full of Frank's archived emails and thought fondly of my grandfather's house and realized that Mexico could, for many reasons, be a good place to settle down. It is my personal preference to be near people, but not among them. I am most comfortable living on the edge of a community, but with a certain degree of alienation from it. Anything in Asia, for example, would be too alien, and anything English-speaking wouldn't be alien enough. Mexico was perfect. Just the right amount of cultural and lingual barrier. I made the arrangements, and that's where I was heading a few days after declining the fat sergeant's gracious invitation. Once in the lakeside area, through an interesting chain of events, I ended up renting a house that was exactly 4 times over my stated budget, but which turned out to be perfect. It was a small estate owned by a pretty famous symphony conductor from a pretty major American city who seldom came down. It was on a hillside, completely walled, and consisted of a main house and a guest house, a pool and a pool house, and all sorts of small buildings, a few gardens and terraces, 6 satellite dishes, and 2 fountains, all packed into just over an acre. It was well out of any town, a 5-minute drive to anywhere. It would be correct to say that I did not wish or choose to live in a place like this. Things just unfolded that way. The property came with a maid and a gardener, a married couple who had been with the estate for years. They had rooms in the main house, but lived elsewhere. The main house also had a beautifully appointed home theater room fully stocked with music and movies because the owner received free copies of everything from the major labels and distributors. I thought I'd get more use from the theater than I ever did. Down from the main house was a casita, a guest house, that was small and comfortable and adjacent to the pool. By the pool was an open pavilion-type building with a kitchenette, a combination changing room-bathroom, and comfortable seating area and fireplace. The long wall that ran along the pool was made of floor-to-ceiling glass panels that could be rolled aside, converting the pavilion to an exceedingly pleasant indoor-outdoor space overlooking Lake Chapala below and the enfolding mountains beyond. A pergola-type roof extended about 10 feet out over the pool deck, So I moved the dining table to the open wall and turned it into a large desk. And that's where I spent most of my time and wrote most of this book. The views were spacious and often gorgeous, especially at sunrise and sunset. In addition to these views, the area was blessed with a near-perfect climate. The extremes weren't extreme, and the usual temperatures were right in the comfort sweet spot. The area was green and lush and bursting with color. The towns were wonderful places to shop and dine and stroll, and lacked little I could want. Certainly nothing I couldn't get in Guadalajara, less than an hour away. Before I knew it, I began house hunting in the towns along the north shore of the lake. In my first week in the area, I found the house I wanted to buy near Upper Ahijis. I made an offer, and it was accepted, which, for a variety of reasons, left me scrambling to put together the entire buying price in cash. This was quite an endeavor, especially in the tight time frame in which I had to do it. But through some tricky maneuvering, some unpleasant tax consequences, and with some good help, I managed it, and I had a local account stuffed with virtually every dime I could scrape together, ready for closing on this lovely home. And then the seller backed out. I found that to be a curious turn of events, but I knew it was for the best, whatever that might be. I waited to see why it happened, and was rewarded less than a week later when I received word that a distant cousin of mine was in need of fast cash and was selling my grandfather's hacienda, the one I wanted more than any other, but had never seriously considered. Now, the seemingly inexplicable action of the seller backing out of the first house after my mad scramble for cash made perfect sense. If it had not been for that, I would not have been in a position to buy my grandfather's house, which I liked much more than the one in Ahijis, and was able to buy at a reasonable price. It was also through the action of finding and trying to buy the Ahijis house that I demonstrated desire and intent, which the universe recognized and rewarded. Lisa, still new with me and still in lawyer mode, couldn't fathom the fact that I signed away all my worldly wealth to buy a house I hadn't seen in more than 30 years without visiting it, inspecting it, getting appraisals, making counteroffers, and all that. My response of, "The way is clear," didn't seem to relax her. Okay, so there's that. We're almost caught up here. The several weeks I spent trying to liquidate my small portfolio of assets for the house purchase was a very jumbled and confusing time. That's when I met Lisa and her daughter Maggie and invited them to move in. That's when I acquired the dog of my heart's desire. And that's when I found out that someone I knew, someone like me, had died. The lakeside area has a lot of American and Canadian expatriates who move here for the ideal climate and low cost of living. Whereas a town like San Miguel is more artsy and young, Lakeside is more elderly and sedate. There are very good medical services available, and Guadalajara is close, so it makes for a popular retirement choice. Frankly, I'll be happier to be living on the edge of a more artistically and spiritually oriented community. Anyway, I wasn't in the area for long before I met a dog named Mango. She was a 4-month-old border collie. She was being walked by her frail-looking owner, a 70-ish woman who had recently retired to the area with her husband. As soon as I saw the dog, I knew it was the one I had been slowly tracking in on for the last year, that we had both been traveling paths that brought us to this meeting. It was a simple recognition on my part, not an impulse or a desire. I knew as soon as I saw her that she would be my dog, and an hour later, she was. In very short order, I paid the woman what she had paid the breeder, though in her relief she'd asked for much less. The dog now had a new owner, and her new name, I perceived rather than decided, was Maya. This woman and her husband had been very ill-advised in their choice of a dog, as she now understood. Border collies are working dogs and can make very poor pets, especially if their circumstances deny them the amount of daily energy expenditure they require. This woman and her husband just thought they were pretty. They are. They're also fiendishly smart and indefatigable, and can go seriously nuts if they don't get the exercise they need. I had started thinking about dogs more and more over the last year, reading books and magazines, gaining knowledge and refining my desires, and had arrived at the realization that I would have a border collie. That was where rightness lay. Once I realized it, I released the whole thing, knowing the details would sort themselves out. Okay, I can't keep this as short as I'd hoped, but all this stuff has to be mentioned. Actually, the dog thing and the house thing are both far more complex and involved and illuminating than I've shown them here, and both, in their fullness, are such clear, intricate, and elegant examples of the processes of manifestations, of the workings of the integrated state, of trust and surrender, of clear seeing, of intent and desire, of the subtle machinations of the universe, of, in fact, the non-dual nature of the I-universe entity, that if I ever decided to write a book specifically on the living reality of the mature integrated state, these two episodes would feature prominently, alongside many other such episodes that irrefutably support my long-standing conviction that the universe is, in fact, a big, playful puppy. I mentioned that it was in that same hectic week that I was informed of the death of someone I know, someone like me. Her name was Brett, and she was truth realized, enlightened, whatever. She taught a small group that met in her writing arena on her Virginia farm once a month, members of which brought my books to her attention and got me invited for a visit. She and I became cohorts, and I visited several times and participated in her group meetings. She died, I learned, on her way home from running some errands. The driver of an oncoming car was distracted with a cell phone, veered off onto the shoulder, overcorrected, and ran head-on into Brett. Brett was killed instantly. The other driver was okay. That catches us up pretty well. The book might still be a bit rough in spots, but it was that, or spend another year smoothing it out cosmetically without improving it in substance. At Lisa's insistence, we removed most of the Spanglish that we all sprinkled throughout every conversation and that I originally thought would be fun to include here. Also gone is a lot of the texture of life in Mexico, good and bad, mostly good. The material about Frank's library and the time he and I spent together and the discussions we had has been cut from this book, but might be made available elsewhere. We'll see plenty more of Lisa, her daughter Maggie, Brett, and the two Mayas in these pages. And we'll end, fittingly, with Lisa and me traveling to Virginia to deliver Brett's eulogy. There, less than 7 pages. Not so bad. Chapter 6, Living the Dream. Affluenza. Now. 1. the bloated, sluggish, and unfulfilled feeling that results from efforts to keep up with the Joneses. 2. An epidemic of stress, overwork, waste, and indebtedness caused by dogged pursuit of the American dream. 3. An unsustainable addiction to economic growth. I'm sitting at my desk, working on my laptop, fumbling through papers and pausing once in a while to enjoy the magnificent view spread out before me, and the piano and cello music piping in through indoor and outdoor speakers. Lisa appears and stands uncomfortably in front of my desk. In the few weeks that she and her daughter have been living on the estate with me, we've had almost no conversation beyond matters of arrangements and daily greetings. I had started to think that the entire summer might pass without us ever really saying more, though I encouraged her to bring her daughter down and take advantage of the pool whenever they wished. "May I?" she asks, pointing to a chair. "Please," I say. She sits and fidgets. I point the remote at what I assume to be a communication node connected to the stereo in the main house, and I lower the volume of the music. Maya sticks her head out from behind the couch to see if anything exciting is happening, and slips back behind it. "Drinks? Food? Help yourself," I say, indicating the kitchenette. "There's lemonade, water, ice, all fine." She nods. "How's the house?" I ask. "It's very nice, thank you," she replies. After her dad introduced us, I learned that she was looking for a place for her and Maggie, so I offered her the guest house on the small estate I was renting. As an afterthought, I realized that I'd be much happier in the casita and that they could have their own rooms and baths in the main house. So, when they arrived, I put them there instead. Between the casita and the pool house, I was very comfortably situated. If I wanted to use the theater room, I still could, but that was the only thing I liked about the main house. The maid and the gardener had their own rooms there too, by law, I think, so it had a less private feel to it. Instead of paying rent, Lisa agreed to handle utility payments and other household functions involving the rental agency and the staff and a whole host of little details that need taking care of. Her Spanish is much better than mine, and she has an easy way with the locals that I haven't developed yet. On her own initiative, she expanded her duties to include all-round guardian of my time and privacy, which was great for me, and seemed soothingly purpose-giving for her. When we met at her father's house, Lisa was clutching a day planner, an uncommon sight down here. I remarked on it at that time, but got no response. Now I try again. "Still got your day planner, I see." Her hand is resting on it. She doesn't reply. I return to my reading. After a few minutes, she releases a torrent of words. "I could be working as a waitress with big hair and a fat ass, living in some flea trap apartment in Corpus Christi when I'm 60, you know." That was unexpected. "Divorced," she says, "alone. Maybe I'd get a Christmas card from Maggie and DJ with a picture of their families. Maybe I'd have some trucker boyfriends, make good tips." "I thought you were a lawyer." "So did I," she says. "I thought I was a lot of things." "Okay. So how do you end up with a big ass in Texas?" She nods and grins as if that were the really funny part. "All the king's horses and all the king's men," she says cryptically.